side, got a man open in the end zone. Stills grabs a touchdown. Kenny Stills, what a pair of hands.
Lehman showing blitz. There's a blitz.
Super job, you're a champion, undisputed.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Bud Berry, Bobby, and Beer podcast. I'm your host, Senna Kamiya. I'm Robbie, and joined by my hosts, Trevor Rogers and Stephen Brown. How are we doing today, y'all?
It's been a decade since we've seen each other, since it's been all three of us.
I know. That's right, because we had a punt last week, and then I think only Trevor was on, one of us two was on the week before, and then it was like the vice versa of that the week before that or something like that. I don't know. So it's been a minute since all of us have been together, so we have a lot to really talk about. We were earlier talking before the podcast about random things, including me probably getting scammed out of an Airbnb, so we'll see how that goes. that's fun. Just trying to protect that customers. But anyways, let's start off with some playoffs, and then we'll get into some gear and hatchet stuff, and then the tight end room, some shooty hoops, because Oklahoma is doing relatively well in the Big 12 as it stands, and then just some other random stuff going on. But so Oklahoma, and for the second year in a row, they have the most representatives in the Super Bowl. You've got Creed Humphrey, James Winchester, Blake Bell, Wanya Morris, all playing from the Chiefs, and Trent Williams and Braden Willis. I forgot Braden Willis was still with the Niners. I mean, if there's like any endorsement for, first of all, like Oklahoma, but also second of all, the offensive line, how do offensive linemen just not flock to Oklahoma? And how does Oklahoma just have down years when this is the case? Is like, I guess my first question just to pose randomly.
Well, it's obviously NIL, right? There's no other excuse for it because, I mean, Oklahoma has the most productive offensive line coach in recent college football history. And then they look at, you know, an offensive tackle that's choosing between OU, Ole Miss, who has two or three tackles already there, and Tennessee, which Tennessee is in a little bit of trouble right now. We'll see where that goes. But
yeah,
it's also a thing where Bill Beatenbow, I mean, he just kind of, I think his philosophy is like, I don't need to take the highest rated guy every year. Like, I'm going to find the guy that's right for me, coach him up. You know, maybe he's here 2-3 years and then he finally hits the field, but I'm going to develop my own guys. I'm going to not really look at the ranking system.
Yeah. How do you feel about Heath Ozeda? Is he a guy or is he just like a depth guy?
I still think he's about probably like another year away. Like, he's a guy that, very athletic for his size. But at the same time, you look at his frame, he was more of like almost a tight end kind of frame coming out of high school. Mm. So the physical development road, it's kind of like the same as Guyton. Like, he was a dude that's out of position, had to get his body right. And, you know, he finally hits the field as an offensive tackle and he looks fantastic. So there could be a similar story there. I just think he's probably a season away from really making an impact if he does.
That's fair. And so, Trevor, like, what do you think about this? I mean, like, you can just go overall as well, as far as Oklahoma having the most players playing in the Super Bowl for some rings. I mean, one of them, like Sooners, you will see have Super Bowl rings and a trophy in their hands at the end of the games.
You know, like, to echo what Steven said, NIL obviously has a ton to do with it. But I mean, even like before the NIL days, it just still kind of seemed like, you know, you look at like the offensive line rooms that, you know, the Alabamas, the Georgias, you know, like they were kind of building like the big SEC programs. And so I think some of it's just, you know, just the marketing of playing in the SEC, it just kind of like Oklahoma being at a disadvantage a little bit there. But also, yeah, to the point of, you know, I think like, wasn't Orlando Brown a three-star kid as well?
Yeah, three-star.
And then, like, he was a three-star guy, yeah.
He was,
yeah,
like, three-star day of addition, and like,
because Tennessee basically cut his scholarship.
Yeah, right. they were going to gray shirt him like at the very last second, and he went to Oklahoma instead. Yeah.
Was that Butch Jones' last recruiting class?
I think so, question
what,
mark?
What a
Butch Jones era, yeah.
Because they went
– yeah.
They did Dooley after Jones, yeah?
Dooley was
– I don't think it was his last, because I think Orlando Brown played against Tennessee with Butch Jones in 2016.
Oh, no. That's right, yeah. That's right, because we had a starting freshman left tackle with Baker Mayfield there.
Right, yeah.
That's right, that's right.
Right.
No, good point.
So, I mean, wow, memory lane. But you look at, like, you know, Creed Humphrey. So those are two guys that when they got to Oklahoma, people immediately talked about, like, immediate impact guys, which is crazy considering they were both three-star guys. Like, wasn't Creed a three-star out of Shawnee?
I don't remember. He ended up being a four-star.
I thought he was four most.
Was he?
Four most. Yeah, that's pretty sure.
Well, and my apologies to Big Creed. I could have sworn that he was a three-star guy.
I think, like, Eddie Radosovich and those guys. I think you're ready to – Eddie Radosovich on those guys, like, said it was, like, a shame he wasn't even, like, a five-star or, like, somebody that was, like, top.
Yeah, no, I definitely get that because I remember, like, the talk was him coming in and he played center his freshman year. And kind of just didn't miss a beat. Was
I'll never let
was,
my
was this
Jonathan Alvarez
year?
Theory go. By the way,
what
I have a my Jonathan Alvarez theory that the year that Creed took over for him, because remember Creed didn't start the season. This is under Lincoln Riley's offense, and my Jonathan Alvarez plays like what four games. And my theory is that they played just that much into the season to get Creed more reps, to get used to the playbook and to get used to the players around him, and then to bench him in favor of Creed, bench Alvarez in favor of Creed. And then mysteriously, like 2 weeks later, Alvarez retired due to like injury or whatever. But I don't know, like, I get weird vibes about it.
Yeah,
like, you. I mean, I remember that, but I mean, stopped.
It like goes to the point of like how like impact Creed Hum, like how big of an impact he made, you know, early on,
yeah.
And like how ready he was as a freshman. So anyway, like all I say, like, Bill's gotten dudes, and I know that it's been like, I really think like looking at Bill Beanbow in the last few years and people kind of seeing like the ebbs and flows, and I get the criticism of the offensive line and some of it's been, you know, just switching scheme in general, but I really think the portal threw Beanbow for a loop, you know, being a development guy and being a, you know, being a, I don't know, just so married to, like, you know, he's a tinkerer, but he wants to tinker with his guys. And then with the addition of the portal, you become like, you got to be a buyer constantly. You got to fill this hole constantly. And so I think it behooves me as to why we've kind of seen this lull, so to speak, in offensive line production. But, I don't know. That was way off point from where we were talking about dudes in the NFL.
No, but it's interesting because like he will, like we will say like he, this past class was not that great, but then like they go to these camps right before they arrive at Oklahoma and they're suddenly like viewed as guys like, oh wow, like they're turning heads. Even David, can't pronounce his last name just yet.
Akinkunmi.
Yeah, Akinkunmi. That's a wonderful name. Just, you know, it's right out the mouth. David Akinkunmi, like he was even turning heads, at least far as like maybe fundamentals. I mean, like that's, I'm pretty sure that's all they really taught at that academy. That's all you can't really do too much of, is just like teach fundamentals and just like have dudes that fit profiles. But I mean, I don't know. It's interesting because at those camps, even Jaden Jackson, he was three-star for quite a while, and he shows up to these camps and to these all-star games, and they're like, oh, he's a guy that's really turning heads as well. And of course, David Stone, it's a no-brainer. And so I just think there's, again, probably that aspect of scouting that's kind of back at Oklahoma that Lincoln Riley also didn't really possess. Also can't really scout into the future for guys pistol whipping each other, but that's just for another conversation.
I could. I can point them out for
you. Hey, they're getting scholarship offers, though, so good for them, I guess, doing whatever they had to do, and then I guess sticking around in Oklahoma and getting scholarship offers from like East Central and stuff. I saw that the other day, but let's talk about the NFL real quick. So let's do quick fire. Steve, I'm coming to you first. Thoughts on Ravens, Chiefs, and Niners, Lions?
Ravens should have won that game. I think they were equally talented as a roster. Just while gotten there, like they were the ones that beat themselves essentially. Like even those key moments where they could close the gap or, you know, tie the game, they just seemed to always make a mistake, whether it's going to be, you know, a personal foul or a fumble or throwing an interception, throwing a triple coverage. Like,
what about that, like back to back possessions? Because the 15-yard penalty for taunting, right?
Yeah.
And then they got another one, which put out a field goal range. And then he fumbled it
on the 1-yard line. I think that was on the same drive, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
That's insane. That was like back to back plays. Sorry, continue.
And he's a rookie, but it's just, I think the experience of the Chiefs also took over. Like they've been in those big moments where like they know they have to make a play. They know they have to be poised. They have to be disciplined. And the Ravens roster just hasn't been there. And that was a learning experience for them.
That's what I was thinking too. What about Niners Lions? Lions took a pretty commanding lead and then did not score for the rest of the game. It was like 24-7, yeah, one and a half.
Didn't watch this one as much. I did watch or go back and watch the decision to go for it. And I think, you know, if I'm Dan Campbell, I think I just take the points there. And I know like the field goal's not guaranteed, but I think I just take the 3 points, get some momentum. You know, you tell your defense, you know, we just got to make one stop and we can take the lead here rather than go. And now you're still down, what, 7 and they score. So I think they kind of buried themselves there. But I know the analytics, they go for it. I don't always agree with the analytics, but it is what it is. They also gave up a huge lead. So,
yeah, I mean, like the Niners look buried in the first half, and then the Lions came out completely flat. So Trevor, thoughts, Ravens, Chiefs, Niners, Lions?
I mean, I would be so pissed if my wife gets a Super Bowl and a fantasy championship in the same year. Like that, that's not fair. So she's a Chiefs fan. So now that I've got that off my chest, the Chiefs, I just said all year. I mean, like I felt like from the end of October on, I kept just saying, "There's no way this team, like, there's no way this team wins the Super Bowl. There's no way this team gets back to the Super Bowl." This is just an okay Kansas City team. I mean, it's Patrick Mahomes, it's Travis Kelce, and it's 9 other guys on offense. Right. You know,
and Creed.
Like, and Creed, you know, and bless Creed. That baby. But like Isaiah Pacheco has been kind of up and down. You know,
something in Rashee Rice towards the end. He's been pretty good for him.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just like things are starting to click, and like Patrick Mahomes looks like Patrick Mahomes again, like throughout the postseason. Like, yeah, that's where I just kind of, you know, sat. When Steven, you made a great point, like those are two evenly matched teams. Yeah, the Ravens had every opportunity to win that game. And I like Lamar. I'm a pretty big Lamar Jackson guy. But Patrick Mahomes wins football games. And having a guy like that, I mean, very, I don't know. I was younger, and so, like, I might have an older listener on this podcast, like, kill me for this. But I just for a fleeting moment was reminded of the early Tom Brady Patriots days, where even, like, some of those teams may not be the best Patriots team that we saw. Like, it wasn't, like, the 15-0 team that we saw, or the 16-0 team that lost to the Giants in the Super Bowl. Like, it wasn't like one of those, but they had some of those early teams where you're like, how are they getting it done? And it just kind of goes to, like, the greatness that is Tom Brady. And in this case, the greatness that is Patrick Mahomes. And then on the other end, I had written off Kansas City's defense like a year ago.
Pretty solid crew.
They've turned into such a solid group. And I mean, just playing excellent football at the right time. And so it was the Patriots formula for years early on. You've got a dynamite defense. You got a really good defense. And if you've just got a really good quarterback, you can win football games. A really good quarterback and one dude. And it just seems like, you know, they're just finding ways to win. And I think that comes with experience.
Yeah.
So, I mean, great football game. I anticipate a great Super Bowl. The NFC Championship game just makes me sick across the board. Like, both of those teams can suck it. I don't like the Detroit Lions. I've never been a San Francisco 49ers fan. I can't get behind the Brock Purdy thing. Like, it makes no sense. And both of those teams, like, were in games to lesser opponents the week prior. And so I sat there thinking, like, neither of these teams are fit to win a Super Bowl. Like, for Detroit to be, like, duking it out in a slugfest with Tampa Bay, and I love Baker Mayfield, but, like, to be duking it out that close, you know, at the end of the game, I wasn't sold on Detroit. And then, as like, I'm a huge Green Bay Packers fan. Green Bay Packers should have won that game. They had every opportunity to win that game, and they didn't. Mm-hmm. And so, like, the NFC Championship, cool, it's fine, it's whatever. Kyle Shanahan may have finally gotten the monkey off of his back, considering he's had to come back in two straight weeks. Sure. He's a pretty damn good football coach. But I am not sold on the San Francisco 49ers. If you asked me that question 3 weeks ago, I thought that they were your Super Bowl champions for sure. But I am not sold on San Francisco winning the Super Bowl.
Well, that, I feel like the answer is that then. I was going to ask quick fire. Who you got? I'll go Niners, and Trevor, seems like you're going Chiefs. Yeah.
I've been wrong all year. And so, of course, now that I picked the Chiefs, you know, they're going to blow it, but that experience is there. They're peaking at the right time. And I'm just, some of the things that San Francisco does just, like, befuddles me, especially in the playoffs. And again, maybe not for Shanahan, and I know that a lot of these guys were on that Super Bowl team just a couple years ago, but it still just doesn't look like a football team that's ready for the moment.
Sure.
Especially Brock Purdy. I'm just not going to get behind it.
And Brock Purdy didn't get to play last time, so that makes sense. Steven, what do you think, Chiefs or Niners?
I'm going to go with the Chiefs. I think they're the more talented roster. They're the more experienced roster, better quarterback. And I think the defenses right now are somewhat similar. I want the 49ers to win, but I'm going to wear my Chiefs jersey and wear the Tyrann Mathieu Chiefs jersey because I think they're going to
probably win by baby
10 points.
Hey, we're hosting a Chiefs themed Super Bowl party here.
I do want the 49ers, though. I want the Super Bowl ring for Trent Williams.
Yeah, I like that. And I don't know. I could see the Niners winning as easily. I could see the Chiefs winning. I think it's a decently matched Super Bowl, which is nice.
They have a good game, yeah.
Yeah, it should be a good game. Like, I mean, they both play really good defense, but one has a superstar quarterback, the other, but both teams have, like you mentioned earlier, like, it's super special not to only have a decent quarterback, but that decent quarterback to have a really, really, really good tight end to throw to. If that, especially if it's he's it's that guy, it really anchors an offense. And so you have Kittle and Kelce kind of facing off there, which is going to be a really important matchup on both sides of defense, on both defensive sides, anyways, obviously. But Oklahoma, they hosted a visit of Garrett Hatchett from University of Washington, which is the Joe Moore Award-winning offensive line, and he made the most starts outside of the starting five. That offensive line had way more snaps played than anybody else, and I think by on three standards, what is now like classified as Oklahoma's best transfer commitment in Steven. Before we get into other like building the offensive line, especially through the transfer portal and what Oklahoma already has, what should we know about Garen Hatchett, especially as an interior offensive lineman?
He's a guy that has a ton of experience, very talented. I think some of the luster gets kind of taken off the commitment because of he just didn't finish the season, like he was injured. But he's a guy that I think, you know, had he stayed healthy, I don't think he would have lost his spot at all on that Washington offensive line. So he's a guy I think Oklahoma needed, not just from like just a talent standpoint, because I do think Oklahoma does have talent, like equal talent on that roster. But he's a guy that's just played so much football and he's played at a high level. And for that guy to, you know, come in and maybe even just be the anchor of that line, be the voice of that offensive line, is just huge for Oklahoma.
Yeah, and I think it's important, right, that he spent time with that team, especially with a great coach, offensive line coach as well, coming to a program where Bill Beatonbow is viewed as a guru of offensive linemen as well. And so I think that's kind of, again, another match where, I mean, like Bill's done really, really great, especially with guys that have transferred in, especially if they transferred in from with even a little bit of talent. I mean, Guyton was kind of an unknown going into OU, and now he leaves OU with a first round grade. And I mean, Wanya Morris walks in OU, leaves with a pretty nice grade. And so, like, even Walter Rouse is going to leaving it drafted in much higher than he would have if he would have stayed at Stanford. So Garen Hatchett, I think, really fits that kind of that mold, especially with Beatonbow. I thought I saw somewhere that Beatonbow was like the second guy that he was really talking to a lot during his original recruitment process. So right. That kind of fit naturally already. And so let's have this conversation of kind of like really building out the offensive line as it is right now, because Oklahoma obviously has Andrew Rame out. Schaefer is out too. Yes, from what I understand, is he coming back? I can't remember if I saw anything.
I think he's coming back.
I thought he was coming back. And so you have Schaefer as an interior offensive lineman, but you've also brought in two tackles, Spencer Brown from Michigan State, Michael Tarquin from USC, whose position was like kind of odd with the whole like herd and whatever stuff. And then you have, I've already said this wrong, Fabechi and Wewu. I don't know. I butchered that name probably. Interior offensive lineman from UNT, who's also a team captain as well. Jake Sexton comes back to Oklahoma with a decent amount of experience at the tackle position, especially in lieu of Tyler Guyton's spot at right tackle. Troy Everett comes in with decent experience in the interior offensive line, albeit it was Appalachian State and spotty at OU. Yeah. I mean, I'll go to Trevor first to make, how do you first feel about, I mean, like you also have Jake Taylor on the list too, and the incoming class like Eugene Brooks. I mean, how do you feel about the offensive line just in general?
Better than I did 2 weeks ago. But I mean, still not super great. You know, it's just, I feel like if anything, you need reps together. You need consistency. And it's just been, you know, patchwork for, you know, the last few years. And going into the SEC, you're curious to see like how quickly does it gel, how quickly does it come together.
Sure.
Is there talent? Yeah, absolutely. It's just it's a lot of fresh names. It's a like I said, I feel better about it, especially you know bringing a guy like Hatchett in, having a guy with you know high level playing experience, you know just get coming out of a national championship game, coming out of winning a national semifinal. You know, you definitely do feel better about having that guy in the locker room, and he's a hell of a football player too. But I still don't know if it's going to necessarily move the needle for me wins and losses wise, if that makes sense.
No, that's totally fair. And Steven, kind of coming off of that, I mean, how would you realistically build out this offensive line knowing who's already on campus and Jake Sexton, that's played plenty of snaps at tackle. I mean, so is Spencer Brown. So is Tarquin, even though he kind of seems like a depth guy, for being honest. And Weiwu from North Texas seems like a guy they really like. Caleb Schaefer played plenty this year, but I'm not sure if that was because they wanted to or if it was out of necessity. I mean, Garrett Hatch just seems like a guy that you can definitely – feels like you can also just like slot him in, same as kind of Sexton, if we're being honest. I mean, and then you have like other dudes like Jake Taylor. But, I mean, how would you build this out, and who would you even start at center? Or who would you feel comfortable with starting at center?
The center battle is interesting to me because you have Josh Bates, I think, who has the physical upside, just hasn't played that much football compared to Troy Everett. So that's a battle I think we're going to just keep watching over the summer and into the fall, because I think it could go either way. As for the rest of the offensive line, I think Spencer Brown's probably your right tackle, most likely. And then you'll have like Gary and Hatchett as your right guard, Fibecchi as your left guard, and Jake Sexton as your
left tackle.
I think that's how it's going to play out early on. Obviously, they're going to move some people around and try different things. And at some point, they're going to say it's not going to gel. We're going to try this guy, and it will all come together, you know, five games into the season like it usually does. But if I had to guess in February now, gosh, that's probably your starting offensive line going into the first game.
And when Bates got to Oklahoma, I heard there were whispers that, I mean, people felt that he had Creed Humphrey-like upside with strictly his physical power that he kind of wields. So I'm not too surprised by that really at all. And so I'm really intrigued to see, because like you mentioned, I mean, Troy Everett seems like an easy shoe-in because he's played so much football. But the prowess and high upside of a guy like Bates is much more intriguing, maybe, especially if it is fire. I mean, trial by fire. I mean, that's what Jackson Arnold's doing. It seems like what a lot of him is doing. But I feel like the offensive line isn't as scary. But again, like you mentioned, and both like you guys mentioned, you've got a great group of individuals, individual talents, especially. But the whole point of offensive line is to be gelled together and to understand like what you need to do collectively as a unit, and not necessarily what you're doing individually, unless it's more of a zone blocking scheme. So you probably might see that a little bit more early, and kind of like switching to a position nearby. Oklahoma tight end room looks different this coming year. They don't just have some rando and like a walk-on.
Mm-hmm.
Caden Helms says he's gonna play, but we'll see if that happens.
Yeah.
You have Cade McIntyre, who Steven, you've been talking about him actually for a while until he got dinged, didn't he? Or they didn't want to, did he get dinged or did he get redshirted? Or both.
A little bit of both.
Okay. That's what I thought. you have Devon Mitchell, who, of course, to me, has very high upside, 6'5", 250 already. And this guy's supposed to be a senior in high school this coming year. And then you added Bauer Sharp from Southeastern. That's in Louisiana as a Division II school, I believe. And then Jake Roberts, also from Baylor. So you have guys on scholarship. Multiple guys on scholarship instead of one guy on scholarship and a few walk-ons going into the SEC. I mean, Steven, I'll come to you first with this one. How do you feel about, is this a tight end room renaissance? Is this a just Oklahoma has now just like fresh bodies that they can throw in, at least four they feel comfortable in, and maybe McIntyre, Mitchell, Sharp, and Roberts, because all of them have played on scholarship with the exception of Mitchell, but he's a very physical specimen that also is really good in the pass game?
I don't know if I would call it a renaissance. I think we get to the renaissance era if Devon Mitchell is really the dude that we think he is. But as for next season, I think it's better. Like on paper, it's way better. Jake Roberts has a ton of experience playing tight end at multiple schools, especially in the Big 12. Caden Helms is still this kind of this X factor where you hear people talk about him as this guy could be, you know, terrific in the passing game, but he just can't stay healthy. So we don't really know what he looks like. Like yep. He's probably what been out.
I only see him on YouTube doing interviews. Yeah.
So like, what is his body gonna look like? How is he gonna look in the passing game? Then Cade McIntyre, a guy that hasn't played a ton of tight end, but you know, he had that one catch and everyone's like, okay, this guy can move and he's got some size. So they're really the only thing going to the spring I think people are going to want to look at is Bauer Sharp, because he looks like a dude like in his film, but he hasn't played tight end. He was a quarterback and transitioned to tight end. You know, what is he going to look like going from Southeastern to now, you know, the Southeastern Conference? So
sure.
Little bit of a big step up there. So if it transitions, great. If it doesn't, you know, you got some dudes to rely on. And maybe Caden Helms stays healthy and he's the guy. Like, you know, this whole conversation about Devon Mitchell and Jake Roberts and Bauer Sharp doesn't matter.
And speak more about going from Southeastern Louisiana, right, to the SEC, and like even in tandem with Sam Franklin, the running back, right, who's from what, Tennessee, Martin. I mean, how yeah. big of a, like, are they, because they're getting guys. Brent Venables made it a very obvious priority to get guys with multiple years of eligibility. And I mean, is this just like, hey, I mean, you're a running back, you got over 1300 yards, you must be good? Or are they just scouting as many guys as possible and saying, okay, they could probably fit in or play a little bit this year and develop and play in the second year more? Like, what do you think is going on there? Because like you mentioned, like, yeah, the Southeastern Conference, but you have other guys there that aren't Division I players either.
Yeah, I think a few things are going on, and mostly this is just to not just like disturb recruiting, especially because if you look at Bauer Sharp or the running back on paper, it doesn't seem that threatening. Like, hey, we're going to bring this guy in. You know, we need someone who's got some experience. We don't have a lot of depth there, so we need him next season. But if you're like a 4 or 5-star kid coming to Oklahoma, you're like, okay, yeah, I can beat this guy out. No problem with the Southeastern. But you're also looking at a guy that is pretty talented, and if it works out, you look like a genius. So sure. And I think in some aspects, like NIL wise, like Bauer Sharp's not going to ask for, you know, a $1 million deal over 3 years. Like, he's going to come in and try to earn his spot, and you know, if he's good, then they'll renegotiate. But I think some of it's NIL, some of it's like, hey, you want to come, you want to play football for Oklahoma in the SEC, you know, we like that mentality, you've got some, you know, athletic talent, come on in. And then some of it's like, we don't want to mess with our recruiting class too much.
Sure, that makes sense. They're rocking the boat. And then, like, especially with NIL dollars and jealousy. And I mean, if he had a cool name like General Booty, he'd be making a lot more money. Trevor, your thoughts on the tight end room? I mean, like, I was griping about the tight ends before the season started. I was griping about the wide receivers too. And that quickly turned out not to necessarily be a problem, especially for a couple of things. Drake Stoops, Nick Anderson, yada, yada. But, I mean, the tight end room heading into this season, it seems less, for some reason, less desperate, I suppose, than last season, where you're just, like, begging Austin Stogner to do anything because he was the only tight end that could maybe do something for you. How do you feel about the tight end room heading into the SEC, heading into this year, in comparison to maybe this past year?
cautiously optimistic. Just for sheer volume, you had two guys in the tight end room last year.
Yeah,
that you could, you know, even think about involving in your scheme.
And one's a walk on.
And one exactly. So now you've got options there, and you know, again, the big, you know, transition. I have no idea if a guy, you know, going from a Sun Belt school, no, D2, right? Yeah, D2 school.
Yeah.
to the SEC. I mean, I know you find like a diamond in the rough in D2 and, sure, and FCS, you know, that, I mean, make
that's
it
what
to
the
NFL.
Transfer, that's what we've said the transfer portal has been doing for talents, right, that just go missing and hidden between the cracks.
Right. And it's, you know, sometimes it's academics, you know, it's, sure, it's, you know, sometimes it's, you know, it's non-football reasons, that put kids there. And I can't say that I have no idea if Bauer Sharp's one of those guys, but he certainly has the build. He certainly has the frame, and it seems like he has the athleticism. And so, I mean, we've seen guys make that transition and be successful. You saw, you know, Blake Bell, make that the transition from quarterback to tight end.
Shit, Lane Johnson was quarterback, tight end, offensive tackle to
All
pro to Super Bowl champ.
Yeah, like, maybe the dude, it's just he finds the right fit, you know, in this position, in that specific position. You know, I'm really optimistic about how Joe John and Seth Luttrell utilize tight ends moving forward.
Sure.
If it's an offensive scheme that I think it's going to be, one thing that I really liked was I liked how Lincoln Riley utilized the tight end position and that,
yeah,
kind of hybrid, you know,
H-backs. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Using that H-back position. And I really thought that, you know, that's kind of what made Lincoln Riley's offenses purr. It was a really tough mismatch. You know, Mark Andrews was just a stud. And you know,
yeah, speaking
I thought
of Mikey Henderson's back on the recruiting market as well.
Yeah, no kidding.
I saw that.
But I mean, I want to trust. I feel optimistic that you at least have bodies to throw in there. You can try some different things, and that wasn't an option a year ago. And schematically, sure, I think it works in Luttrell's offense.
Would you guys take Mikey Henderson today, knowing he also has grown man strength too?
I mean, I would if it was my program.
See, that's what I'm saying. I would too. I take the chance.
Yeah.
Now we'd have to discuss some gun safety.
That's correct.
Before he puts a jersey on. Yeah.
Firearm safety. I mean, it's not Texas. You can't wield a sword anywhere you'd like to. So, but,
I mean,
you know,
it's not like Oklahoma hasn't welcomed back, you know, people with heinous offenses in the past. So,
you know, it happens, you know, like as soon as you score a touchdown, people forget. And that's right. How
DGB things never even played.
Yeah, that's no shit. Right. That's wild to think about. Can you imagine if he actually played too? Anyways, Trevor hates Oklahoma basketball.
Holy shit. I read
the last time we podcast. So we didn't podcast last week, and that's mine. My bad. And the week before, I had Trevor give his elevator pitch on why we should watch Oklahoma basketball. And this is when they were 16-3, still doing really well in the season, still are doing well in the season, by the way. Or they were like 15-2 or something like that. Somewhere along those lines. And they go on a 2-game skid. They have a bad half against Texas, right? They were up by one at the break, and they get out rebounded really badly in the second half of that game in Norman. So that hurts. then they just kind of pissed down their leg in the second half and down the stretch against Texas Tech. Also in Norman, that's a game that you should win. You should be 17-4 right now. And they just pulled away. They pulled away late in Kansas State in Manhattan. I mean, it looks like a blowout, but it wasn't really necessarily a blowout the entire game. And first, Trevor, I want to get your reaction. A, why do you hate Oklahoma basketball by giving your elevator pitch about why this team is so great, and then they went on a two-game skid, especially on at least one game they definitely should have won? And B, still, what are your thoughts on the team knowing that they are still 16-5? I mean, it's the Big 12. Wins are hard to come by.
They, you know, maybe Oklahoma basketball hates me. Have we considered that?
You know, it's possible.
it's possible. It's just like it's perfect. It's so poetic that I've been just so cynical. And we talked about this even a few weeks ago. Like, how many times after the non-con schedule have we talked about, man, this Oklahoma team, you know, they could make waves. You know, they're going to be a top 25, top 15 team all year.
Sure.
And this year really, really felt different. It did. It felt so real. And yet Oklahoma fans still don't show up. They don't go to the Louisville Center.
They're doing better.
And conference play helps, and having a shit non-con schedule. Like, I know people love to say, like, you got to go out and support that team, but I'm sorry. I don't give a shit about watching OU play Washburn. Please, for the love of God, bring in Gonzaga one year. Bring in, like, somebody. Give me somebody with a pulse, a real basketball program to come play here. Because otherwise,
you're doing with it the Chapel Hill.
Right. Yeah. And not even Chapel Hill. You're fucking playing in Charlotte.
That's right. Yeah.
You play a neutral site. And so, like, I miss the all college. There's a random tangent. We'll come back to another day. Rest in peace. Come back, baby. But it's just kind of so poetic that, you know, people start to buy in and you think, oh, maybe Porter Moser's really got it finally figured out. And then they shit the bed. Get their ass kicked by Texas. And then, I'm sorry, like, I know Oklahoma did not have a shot to win the Big 12 this year, but to be in that discussion, to be a 4 or 5 seed in the tournament, like, you've got to protect home court. You have to win every game at home. And I'm not sold that this is a great Texas team. And that's a Texas Tech team that's very beatable. And you go out and you do that. And then, like, it blows my mind. I thought it was illegal to win in Manhattan, Kansas. Lon Kruger had me convinced that, like,
just children thing.
Would die if Oklahoma won a basketball game in Manhattan, Kansas. And they go out and they beat the hell out of a pretty good Kansas State team. So I have no idea what to make of it. I still think they could be a really fun, good basketball team that's just the product of a really, 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 really tough league. And they're way, way, way better than they have been. And I think that they're going to wind up being a lock for the tournament. But the fact that we're having this conversation, we're starting to that it's creeping into our minds of, okay, are we sure that Oklahoma's going to make the tournament this year? Are we, like, what's got to happen? What's their remaining schedule? Does Oklahoma for sure get into the tournament this year? Is that it? And it's also, is that good enough? Is that enough for Porter Moser to keep his job?
I think yes. I think yes. I mean, like, that's a big thing going to the SEC, especially when their basketball programs aren't as good. Steven, my question to you is, has this team caught your attention at all?
I'll be honest, the last time I watched OU basketball, I flipped it on for OU Texas. I think it was almost towards the halftime. Mm-hmm. And I think OU was up one or down one. something like that.
Yeah.
And then Texas went on a run and I just turned it off. So if they make the
tournament,
usually, I'll watch it. But
yeah, that's usually
it's extremely hard to get my attention, especially when I can, you know, I can either watch OU basketball or I'm watching huddle films. So
sure.
Kind of.
And like Steven is my pulse for the OU fan base as far as basketball and whether or not on how we're doing on the product.
It is.
On how we're doing on the product. And I mean, like, if you tune in for a little bit, that tells me like we're curious and we'll maybe show up to some games as a fan base, but we're not too invested like the buddy years. And of course it's not, but it's not like to the point where right after the buddy years where you had Jordan Woodard just by himself where nobody talked about Oklahoma basketball. So we're making some sort of progress, I suppose. It's Oklahoma.
The TV was on for about 3 minutes, three or 4 minutes.
Oh shit. Right. For real. But but Oklahoma, like Trevor mentions, they Long Kruger leaves and suddenly they can win in Manhattan, and not only win in Manhattan but win big in Manhattan, even though they pull away at the end, snapping that skid, playing again really some sharp defense, getting transition bucket. That's what they do, that's what Porter Moser does. The Lloyd Noble Center, quite frankly, I mean, like, as a top 25 team going up against several other top 25 teams, I mean, the Lloyd Noble Center atmosphere has been a lot better in comparison to years past. So I would say kudos to everybody that shows up to the games. I went to one, just the most recent one, the Tech one, where they pissed down their legs. So that was very disappointing, obviously. But, I mean, everybody was having a good time. That's probably the loudest I've seen Lloyd Noble in a while. And so you could still smell the stale popcorn everywhere, though. So there's that. And just a random congrats to Jenny Baranchek, that the OU women's team, they started off really slow non-con, and they're like only one loss in conference play and just took down number two
Kansas State. She's a
hell of a
basketball coach, man.
Yeah, she's doing wonders with that team right now. They're young right now, so that makes sense. But sheesh.
And the way they're doing it too, it's a different recipe every night.
Yeah, and I think it's impressive, and I generally love like what they're doing right now. OU men's basketball team 16-5. It looks like in the Big 12, you only have to win about 19 to 20 games to make the tournament. Now, the schedule remaining, it doesn't look too arduous. I mean, what, you go to UCF, you play BYU, you actually have a home-and-home series with Oklahoma State, which they are not a good team. You also have a tough games with Baylor, Kansas at home. At Iowa State, Houston is going to be potentially a very bad time, but at least you get to welcome Kelvin Sampson back to the arena. Cincinnati, they've already beat, and then they go to Austin to end the season. So that's a kind of a cool way to, I guess, end your in the Big 12, I suppose. And so, I mean, I could see, I guess, four games there that they could pencil in as wins. Do we feel like this is a tournament team? Let's say Oklahoma does only win 20 games. What seed are they? Like, are they a 6-8 seed? 6-9 seed?
Probably 6-9.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, very nice. And like that would make sense. I mean, they're athletic. They can shoot the ball a little bit. They're still a little bit inconsistent. They're not necessarily a big team, but they are a very long and athletic team. And I mean, like, anytime Otega Oweh runs a break, everybody just like is anticipating just the most nasty throwback dunks, and it's just the most fun thing. So again, a team that's I was worth tuning into, like Steven mentioned, like he checked it out, at least a team worth looking at, a team that definitely seems like a tournament team, especially if they can take care of a couple of games. I think three more wins will get them in. And just random things. All right. So we found out who the Super Bowl performers are. You've got Usher, which is like, I don't know what led that process. I mean, in years past, you had Beyonce twice. I thought the Bruno Mars Red Hot Chili Peppers one was really good. That's probably one of my favorite ones, if we're being honest. But we're getting Usher. So the older millennials and the younger boomers are pretty happy about that. And he's got some hits. Don't get me wrong. Usher's good. But on Nickelodeon, they are doing a reanimated CGI version of the SpongeBob Sweet Victory marching band episode. Between these two, which halftime show are you guys tuning into?
The Bubble Bowl. Without question.
I agree.
Steven? I'm probably not going to watch either. Maybe Usher, because I know I'm watching in a friend's group. They're not going to switch a channel.
Yeah, that's fair.
But I will.
Right?
I'll watch SpongeBob on. I'll watch it on YouTube after.
And see, like that's the thing, right? Like, if I usually every year my family goes to Vegas for the Super Bowl just to have a good time, go see some shows, and then but also since my family frequents Vegas so much, it's absurd. We end up staying in Bellagio because they build up like all these points systems through whatever the casinos are from. And then we go to like Mandalay Bay or something like that and watch the Super Bowl on like four massive screens. And well, they're not going to turn the channel
Book
from
at Mandalay
Usher.
Is all the, around. It's so cool.
It's fantastic. Yeah. I mean, they're not going to change a channel from Usher to SpongeBob, but if I'm watching at home, I might actually just tune into the Bubble Bowl this year, even though I am curious what new stuff Usher's going to try to play, because everybody knows what we ultimately want to hear is My Boo, and if he doesn't play it, he's kind of failed to all of us, if we're being that honest with each other as far as his halftime performance. Like, that's iconic. So, I mean, yeah, I guess that makes sense.
Did Usher do I Wanna Make Love in This Club? Was that
man?
Usher?
Talking about
I think it's Usher song,
with a
stripper.
Yeah, having sex with a stripper in a club, man.
Yeah, all right, cool. Like, that's it. That's what I'm there for.
That was a good attempt.
Hey, and you know,
I appreciate that.
It was great. Their vocals are like an angel. you're the songbird of your generation. And I haven't watched Step Brothers in a long time. I need to. You can call me Nighthawk.
Did you touch my drums?
Gosh. John Bonham's playing Moby Dick for real. This is like the stuff we do before the podcast. If you would be interested in paying for that. Usher's good. But sense. Again, like, I feel like they felt like they had to do that after a couple of years of the cultural playoff and the Super Bowl being like very hip hop and being very that way, like they have to go like the pivot the opposite direction and stuff like that. So I don't know. It's weird. I don't really care. Nobody really can.
I still feel
attention.
Like Usher was a backup choice. I feel like they like landed on Usher.
How the hell do you go from like Lady Gaga? You have Lady Gaga, you have Bruno Mars, you have even the fucking Red Hot Chili Peppers are willing to come on your show, and now we get Usher? You kidding me?
Well, the thing is, like, a lot of those people that perform, they pay for it themselves, basically.
Yeah, to get publicity.
And then they make all their money back when people stream their music and all that stuff.
I did not realize that.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Super Bowl, and not Super Bowl, but it's kind of like the Olympics. Those cities lose money, but in tourist attractions after the Olympics, they gain all of it back. Like same thing with the World Cup.
Yeah. Unless you're Beijing or Rio.
That's
so someone
correct.
Just didn't want to pay.
Yeah. That Usher baby. So maybe we'll play some of his classics. Hope he doesn't play any of his new stuff because it's not the same. It's just not the same. But anyways, Pick Six Previews is an account on Twitter that I thought put out some pretty fun stuff to think about after the season. They mentioned Oklahoma leads the NFL, not just in the Super Bowl attendees and participants, obviously, but they lead the country in the NFL for the second year in a row. And I thought that was interesting. And then they mentioned Nick Anderson has 22 catches of 15 plus yards or more. And that leads all freshmen in the NCAA. And you know, you're bringing Jaleel Farouk back. You know, you're bringing in Andrew Anthony back. you know, you're bringing in what's his face? Deion Burks from Purdue, and like so you have a decent like wide receiver squad coming in. Then Sawchuk leading off freshman tied to freshman running backs and touchdowns with 9. If he stays in there during the Arizona game, he probably leads all freshmen even more with double digit touchdowns and graded the 7th best running back in his class from the season. And so in retrospect, just even thinking about the contributions of the young guys this season, yes, with the seasoned Dylan Gabriel, who came back much better than he came into the 2022-2023 season.
Dude's going to win
a much better quarterback. He might if he's put in the right position. And so in retrospect, thinking about this, is this a good launching point? Does this change our frame of mind? And Trevor, I'll come to you first, and Steven. Does this change your frame of mind of Oklahoma going into the SEC offensive line? You just secured a guy from Washington that's played high-level football. You said you've secured another interior offensive lineman from North Texas who seems he's a team captain. He seems like a guy that can play D1. You've got a couple of tackles, already a guy on campus that you feel comfortable in starting at tackle. The tight end room seems less daunting. The wide receiver room actually seems a lot better. The running back room seems pretty decent. You got a backup quarterback. Looking at everything that I just said, especially on the offensive side, how do you feel about this? Does this change your frame of mind? Are you still just like hands off? We haven't seen anything yet. It's still spring. Everybody looks good in shoulder pads and shorts.
Yeah, it's still spring for me. You know, like I think to me, I guess it moves the needle a little bit that I feel solid about. Yeah, I think 8 wins is like should happen. You know, I was kind of there. You know, they could go 7-5 next year. But you know, I think I talked about like we talked previously that like the ceiling was maybe 9 wins.
Yeah.
But you know, now like that game, you know, with Alabama coming to town, you know, they're still going to be like loaded with talent, but things are kind of a mess in Tuscaloosa. And so like,
people
forget
about Tennessee losing their starting quarterback and they're kind of mess right now too, in their program anyways. And I am.
Yeah. So like, you know, maybe the schedule plays out a little easier for Oklahoma. So you've got that going for you. It's just still like, again, like how quickly does the offensive line gel?
Sure.
And you know, depth on the defensive line, you know, it's youth. I feel better about some things, but to make a real impact and to push the envelope, you know, at 9 wins in the SEC, not up, but throughout the season, being competitive, maybe I'm just completely overhyping what the SEC is like. Maybe that's just it. It's just the needle has not moved much for me. I do feel better,
yeah,
but I'm still just like, yeah, I'm gonna take everything with a grain of salt.
And I could see where you could might even say, I mean, 9-3 in the SEC. I mean, that gets you close to that gets you in the
that'll teams. Get you in the playoffs.
That gets Lane Kiffin a contract extension.
That definitely gets you in the teens. That gets you in the teens of the rankings, and you're thinking about playoffs at that point. And so, Steven, kind of same question, not kind of, obviously the same question. With all of this in retrospect, with the youth talent really on full display, especially at skill positions, and then you got guys like Jaquez Pettaway who haven't been able to shine as well, and Danny Okoye and other guys that are coming along, and then the defense is, you got a lot of guys coming back, of course, like Trevor just mentioned, you got guys in the trenches that, you know, we'll see, wait and see on that, with Schmitty especially, because they are in their third year of a system. Does any of this, especially with the young talent boosting up and then the transfers coming in, does this change your frame of mind about Oklahoma heading into the SEC, even though it is February 1st?
A little bit, and maybe not next season, because I think next season you're looking at probably 8 wins, maybe 9 if you can split something between like a Missouri and Ole Miss.
Yeah, that's it. Those are,
I think,
two of them.
The longevity for OU, I think it's fine. Like, you're looking at Brent Venables, you know, this is last season was technically, you know, season one, because he has more of his guys playing. He has more development. So if he's going to continue to stack talent and develop talent like he's doing on the defensive side of the ball, and then offensively, we'll see where they're at with the new offensive scheme. It's going to be a program that's, you know, going to vie for the playoffs pretty much every season from here on out. You know, maybe it's not a championship, but, you know, with a 12-team playoff coming in, Oklahoma's going to have a shot every single year to be in the playoffs and be in the postseason. And I think that the overall health of the program continues to get better despite, you know, what people may think of the offensive line, the offensive system. You know, Brent Venables still has some things to learn. I think everything's still continuing to move in the right direction.
And as when you mentioned Brent Venables has a lot to learn, do you feel like Seth Luttrell kind of accelerates that process, especially by being in that position for that many years at North Texas, at least? And I know North Texas is a completely different situation and scenario than Norman, Oklahoma, and then Denton, Texas. But do you feel like that also like gives him, like, he's not the Ted Roof. He's a guy that's already run a program and a guy that was under Venables and a guy that they have a relationship, a deep relationship with. Do you feel like he also maybe doesn't maybe lean on Seth Luttrell for that, but definitely seeks his advice in addition to Bob, who's very present still with the program and he's still very close with him?
I think it takes some pressure off of him, and not like he's going to say, hey, we should do this. It's more like he can say, hey, you know, Seth needs you to run the offense situationally. You know what to do. You've been in these situations. I'm going to trust you. I don't have to be hands-on with this. I can, you know, step in if I really need to, but, you know, this is your show. And I think he'll do fine in that aspect, because he'll be up in the box. You know, he'll have all the stats and everything he needs to do to make decisions. And then you also have Zach Alley, which, you know, I think maybe not next season, but, you know, two seasons away, like, he's going to be the defensive coordinator. Like, he's going to make the calls. He's going to have the personnel, all that stuff. That's going to allow Brent Venables to step even further away from the defensive side and kind of just be a game manager at that point, like a CEO type coach.
And that's kind of the role we've been talking about wanting him in, as far as overseeing the entire game. Yes, sure, helping the defense on critical downs and critical situations, more time management, more overall over game view, tendencies of both sides of the football, and being immersed on both sides. I think it's really important. And so, kind of maybe closing this podcast out, some news drops. Baker Mayfield, a guy that is heading to the Pro Bowl after being written off once again by, I mean, like, how many Pro Bowls has Baker been to? Two? Three? Two?
Oh, this is two?
He definitely went to one with the Browns.
That's luck.
Yeah, the year that he got them their playoff win.
Probably didn't go with the Panthers, though.
Probably not. But so, like, let's talk about that. I mean, regardless, he's now in the Pro Bowl, even though, like, it has to do with, like, opt outs and stuff like that. But still, to be viewed as one of the top peers in the National Football League, I think says a lot. I mean, again, Trevor and I talked about this. So what?
It might be his first Pro Bowl.
Really?
Yeah,
it is. That's what I thought.
Was he just voted to Pro Bowl by, like, certain associations?
Like, probably something like that, yeah.
Okay, that makes more sense. But again, I mean, guy gets a Pro Bowl playing for the Buccaneers and taking them to the playoffs, upsetting a team, and then having a little bit of fun. And so, again, Steven, since you didn't get on this conversation last time, what do you think Mayfield's ceiling realistically is in the NFL? I mean, like, he definitely seems like a guy that should be playing for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. He definitely fits that vibe. But what is his ceiling? Is it just simply NFL quarterback starter? Is that his ceiling? Is that where he's currently at?
Probably. I think so. I kind of feel like he might be a Ryan Fitzpatrick type quarterback, where, like, he's always gonna be pretty good. Like, he's always going to be there as maybe, like, the veteran guy while you have someone, like, waiting in the wing. But maybe he doesn't take, like, the next step, and he's, you know, like, an all-star quarterback that wins you a Super Bowl. I just don't know if like that's his caliber. But, you know, it's Baker, and every time you doubt Baker, he seems to deliver. So,
hey, Fitzmagic is fun. I like Fitzmagic. He went like where'd he go to university? He was an Ivy Leaguer.
I think it was a Harvard.
I think it was it Harvard. Harvard.
It was a nice school.
It was one of the more expensive ones.
It was the Ivy League school. Just throw the dark there.
I think, but I like that comparison as far as not necessarily like play style or who he is as a quarterback or what his talent is, but like the whole idea and concept of Fitzpatrick as a quarterback that. Yeah, he's good enough to win you games, and he's not like a guy that you're just going to hand the ball off. Like, you feel comfortable with him pulling the trigger and actually throwing those balls, and you feel like he's a guy you can win with, especially if you need a Band-Aid on your team, too. Like, if you need a backup quarterback that can give you, like, legitimate snaps instead of some guy, again, like I just mentioned, that you're just going to hand the ball off, like a Davis Bevel kind of type. I mean, he's your guy. And so, again, Trevor and I talked about this. I mean, Trevor, Baker Mayfield going to a Pro Bowl first time, apparently, like legitimately this time. Of course, somebody steps out, he gets in. I mean, is his ceiling starter level and that is it? He's not going to rise any further above this? Or can he, do you feel like his career could go a little bit more, like a float a little bit above that starter level, but never above maybe a above average starter?
I think it's so like circumstantial in how well the Bucs front office like kind of builds that roster around Baker Mayfield and if he really is like in the long term plans. And when I say long term plans, I mean like next 2 to 3 years, right? Because a big contract payday, like it's got to be coming. You know, I mean the Bucs got him on a steal. So the dude's going to get a pay raise, but I mean, think about it. Like if the Bucks are saying, hey, we got to hit the reset button in 3 to 4 years anyway, you know, is now the time that you like, you draft your project quarterback, to sit behind Baker Mayfield and which they may already have in Kyle Trask.
Yeah.
But sit behind Mayfield for a couple of years, a veteran guy with experience. But you know, what happens if, let's look at Baltimore, who has found a new tight end, right? With what's his name?
Isaiah Likely.
Isaiah Likely, yes. I always crack up every time I see his jersey when it says Likely 80. Yeah. I think of that meme, like how many beers am I going to have? Likely 80. Yeah. And so, you know, I've like, how high is Baltimore on a guy like Mark Andrews coming back next year when Likely is seems to like, you know, he's healthy, he's a little younger, you know, can kind of fill that role. Do the Ravens potentially look at, you know, making a move for, you know, on a guy like Andrews? And you look at a team like Tampa Bay, I'm wish casting here. Like, Would you take a risk in reuniting like a Mark Andrews type, you know, player with Baker Mayfield? I look at like if Baker can get a few more weapons, and if
he's already got Tampa, Mike Evans too,
right?
With the experience,
right? If Tampa can get some help, you know, on the defensive side of the ball, like you're in that perfect spot where you really can start your rebuild and get your experience in there, and still be really competitive. Maybe the ceiling for him this year was him being a Pro Bowler and being a great story, but I don't think it's unrealistic, especially in that division, for Baker to go on and, you know, continue to make the playoffs for a couple of years. And who knows? Maybe he goes on a magical run and Baker Mayfield leads Tampa to the NFC Championship game. I think that would be his ceiling, but that is more than likely completely out of his hands.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, again, you're not the GM, just a quarterback that is kind of like on like hunting on contracts, and he happens to really come into his own for the Bucks. So good for him. But that is all that I have. I mean, we have to wait a couple weeks for the Super Bowl, not just one like the other playoff games. So be chilling for a week or so, but there's definitely some OU basketball to watch that I would recommend, especially with Oklahoma's only meeting with UCF. But before we hop off, Steven, Trevor, any last words before we end this thing?
We should probably touch on Junior Day, the first one. The second one's coming up Saturday. But Oklahoma pretty much hit it out of the park with the guys that were there, especially the priorities, like Jonah Williams, the five-star safety slash linebacker, whatever you want to call him, you know, athlete. They seem to be in a really good spot there. Probably lead at this point, but that's, you know, with the five-star battles, they're going to go up and down throughout the summer, and it kind of comes down to the official visits, so... Probably don't want to get too excited yet, but there's some stuff to feel good about there. And then you look like a guy like Max Granville, who kind of looks like Danny Aquay's younger brother as a pass rusher. So I think they're in a really good spot there.
And it sounds like the 2025 class is like shaping up to be a really, really, really good one, and especially in comparison to 2024 too.
It's interesting. There's a lot of talent, especially in the offensive line. So if you look at like 2024, that was all defensive line. And people will talk about, you know, not being able to recruit offensive linemen. It's because they just weren't there. Like, they weren't regional. Regional-wise, there's probably 8 guys that Oklahoma could probably get that are, you know, high-caliber, 4-star athletes on the offensive line. So it kind of flip-flops from 2024 to 2025 in the trenches there. But... You know, Max Granville is a guy that I think Oklahoma's has a good shot with. They have to overcome Texas and Texas A&M and probably LSU. But right now they seem like they're in the driver's seat. And then Colby Sellers, 4-star defensive back, also in a pretty good spot for him. So a lot to be excited about. And I think the other thing that needs to be stated, a lot of people think this is going to be a smaller class, maybe 20 guys or so. You know, if the talent is there, I wouldn't be surprised if they push this thing to 22, 23 guys. So, something like that. But you can also follow along recruiting wise on Discord, free to join, and the link will be somewhere on Twitter. It'll be below this podcast.
It certainly will. I've already even got it linked down in our doc, and I'm curious to see what the spring exits will be like for Oklahoma as far as guys that eventually leave the program, too. I'm curious
to see process because they're over the scholarship limit. So they're either going to escort some people out or do the preferred walk-on plus treatment for a few guys.
Yeah, I'm very, very, very curious to see who gets that open door policy as far as talking about realistic futures. And so I think that's very interesting. Trevor, anything that you would like to also add toward the end of the podcast? Would you like to curse Oklahoma basketball some more?
No, I'm not going to say a thing about Oklahoma basketball. I just wanted to give a quick shout out to one of my clients. I just got back. If anybody listens, are racing fans, just spent a whole week at Daytona. Rolex 24 hours of Daytona, which is really it's one of the coolest races in the world. It's a 24-hour endurance race. If you're a racing fan, it's a big deal. It's a very prestigious event. And one of my clients on the Mazda side of things is a really, really talented kid named Connor Zillich. He's 17 years old. He just got his actual driver's license a year ago. And was on the on a winning team. He drove about 6 hours, a little over 6.5 hours, for Era Motorsports in the LMP2 class, one of those super cool prototypes. He's the second youngest winner ever of the Rolex 24, and that race is over 60 years old. So it's a big deal. He's a great name. He's a really good guy. Comes from a great family. If NASCAR fans, he's going to be definitely a guy that you want to follow. Just signed with Trackhouse Racing, and so he'll be making his ARCA. He's already made his ARCA debut, but running in the Xfinity Series this year, the Truck Series, and I don't think it'll be long before you see him on the Cup side of things. So major congrats to him, and Rolex 24 was a really awesome weekend.
I smell illegal activity on how young he was when he started driving, because I did not start until I was 16.
No, I mean, you can get a race car at 14 years old.
My dad got me a go-kart when I was like 10, and I ran into a mailbox and mowed it over and just pulled it off and drove off, even though it's kind of a federal offense. So, but I was 10. So, you know, like, what are they going to do? That's quite
the... He's carded against some of the kids that are, let's say, kids.
Quite the accolades for somebody that young. So I smell illegal activity.
Well, I think, like, Lando Norris, I think, is the most notable F1 driver that he carded against back when he was really young. So he's driven against some of, like, the biggest drivers in the world. They started these drivers, like, 4 years old.
The guy I want for my driver, if I ever get one fancy enough, is Gideon from The Righteous Gemstones, which is a show that I think all of us will highly endorse.
Yeah.
As they mentioned, he's one hell of a wheel man. So I think we'll leave the podcast. Jesse Gemstone. I think get out of here, nerd. Go with that nerd stuff. Oh man, let's go ahead and wrap this thing up, guys. Everybody, thank you for listening. We've got a lot of stuff done, talking about Super Bowl, talking about Oklahoma, offensive line, how we feel about the teams, even their young talent growing up. He has some shooty hoops that you guys should really be paying attention to, because this definitely is a tournament team. Just not sure what kind of tournament team it is right now. They remind me of the West Virginia teams that used to get out and run. And so go ahead and follow us on Twitter. You can follow Trevor at TrevorRogers_1. Go ahead and follow Steven at OUUpdatedSB. You can find me, Kamir, at K_Morabian. And then, like Steven mentioned earlier, the Discord link will be in the bio of this podcast and also on the Linktree description on Twitter. And thank you guys for listening, and we'll check you guys later.